Dr. Becky Alexis Martin is a pacifist academic at the University of Bradford. Her work explores nuclear warfare, social justice, humanitarian and environmental issues, and human rights. Her expertise is focused on nuclear geographies and decolonizing disarmament policy in the Pacific. She has authored over 65 news articles, book chapters, and peer-reviewed articles. Her first book, Disarming Doomsday, The Human Impact of Nuclear Weapons Since Hiroshima, critically considers the social, cultural, and spatial harms perpetuated by nuclear warfare, and was the recipient of the 2020 LHM Ling Outstanding First Book Prize. And I've read the book. It's a really, really great book. I would really recommend this. Very clearly written, and I learned a lot from reading that. So, while reading that, I put together some questions, which we shared earlier. And, so if it's okay just to dive straight into that one, I'll read this one out. So you quote the geographer Yves Lacoste. Geography serves first and foremost to wage war. I mentioned the work of Halford Mackinder. How has the academic discipline of geography been used to assist the development of nuclear weapons, particularly in relation to indigenous peoples, upon whose land many nuclear tests were carried out?
I think this is a really good question to start. When we think about geography, we kind of want to think about what's mapped and unmapped. So one of the ways that geography has kind of assisted the development of nuclear weapons is through this kind of recognition of isolated spaces for nuclear weapons testing itself. So geographers were key in kind of identifying appropriate locations for nuclear weapons testing and their criteria for a good place was that it could kind of create almost like a laboratory environment. So there weren't lots of communities who were well known nearby. Indigenous communities were there, but not maybe white communities or colonial communities. And it was far enough away from kind of the hubs of empire. So for the UK, that would be the UK, the USA, or France, for example. For the USA and France, it was far enough away from these kind of central regions to kind of keep it out of sight and out of mind. And also things like kind of the natural environment were considered because they wanted kind of particular geologies or particular environments for nuclear weapons testing. I think a lot of the time they wanted, flat spaces that were easy to observe. So deserts were popular, as were island environments, because you've got this contained, micro environment, essentially, this, with its own ecology that can then be monitored and explored after testing. So physical geography was really important, and human geography was important too, I'd say, in this kind of making sure that the tests were far away from kind of cities. Unfortunately, the nuclear weapons tests planning neglected the presence of Aboriginal and Indigenous communities near the nuclear weapons tests. So the impacts of this are particularly stark in places like Lop Nor in China, where the Uyghur people were affected by the nuclear weapons tests, the far north Siberia, where communities again were affected, and in Australia and across the Pacific. So with the Pacific and Australian nuclear weapons tests, they were undertaken by the UK, France and the USA. And the UK for the Australian and Pacific tests didn't even classify the Indigenous Aboriginal and Torres Straits Islanders as human, and they were described as part of the flora and fauna, until the late 1960s. So this is very dehumanising, of course, and an example almost of what I would call like unhuman or inhumane geographies rather than human geographies, whereby these people were not given their right to self-determination and recognised as human beings. So I'd say those are kind of some of the more interesting ways and relevant ways that geography was relevant. geotechnologies were also essential. So a lot of the kind of test planning relied upon an understanding of the atmosphere and the environment and the weather, because weather conditions needed to be perfect in order to get that, you know, idealised mushroom cloud and reduce the likelihood of heavy fallout. Of course, this was not always possible. And we can refer, for example, to the Grapple X nuclear weapon test in 1957, which was undertaken by the UK and Carissimas, and unfortunately was undertaken in the wrong weather conditions and led to fallout, or at least rainfall that potentially contained radionuclides afterwards. So that kind of gives you a bit of a insight, really, into how the discipline of geography is being used in the development of nuclear weapons and the testing.
Yeah, and as you were mentioning there, areas of the world that are supposedly safe to testing, but obviously people live there. It also made me think of, even in the UK, where areas of Scotland were considered for nuclear tests, like the Outer Hebrides, which today is the site of the missile range testing, etc. So, you know, it's also that kind of dehumanisation also was close to home in supposedly desolate areas, which weren't; they were populated.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And there's another similar site down in Portland as well, where the rocket technology that was used at the Woomera test site in Australia was originally tested, obviously without the nuclear weapons. So these kind of peripheral areas in the UK as well have this initial consideration. But then, of course, the decision was that it should be undertaken further away. So, yeah, very good.
A thought occurred to me then as well, perhaps, you know, reading your book, I'm just reminded now of the class character of the testing as well. You talk about many of the soldiers who experienced these kind of tests, and it seems that, you know, the rank and file were often working class people who didn't really know what they were being led into, and they kind of suffered the ill effects of that.
Absolutely, yeah, this is a big problem. You could very much say that it falls into this idea of kind of health geographies as well, because there's definitely a spatiality to who was affected and who wasn't. You needed to be at the tests at a particular, you know, time, and some of the servicemen were lucky, some of them weren't. One of the big challenges, actually, that we face at the moment is the ongoing kind of contestation that nation states have against their own servicemen, where there's kind of a belief that, you know, perhaps the effects weren't so severe, perhaps, you know, no liability should be admitted. This is a challenge that is currently an issue with the UK, actually, and will soon be an issue with the US, with changes in their laws to protect nuclear test veterans. So there's a lot to think about there, really, I think. With those communities in particular, there's a new, well, I say new, it's a relatively new treaty. It's called the 2021 Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. And if you're listening to this, I hope you go away and look it up and have a little read. It's made, invented, I guess is a good phrase for it, invented by the United Nations. And it's a treaty that aims to prohibit nuclear weapons development and testing completely. Now, the reason I find it very interesting in the context of both the nuclear test veterans and the local communities is because this treaty has two articles. Article 6, for the protection of humans and environment, so humanitarian and environmental assistance, and Article 7, which calls upon other members of this treaty. So there's like 96 member states now, and lots of NGOs, so lots of organisations like the Red Cross and the Red Crescent have also, and Norwegian People's Aid, give them a shout out, have also signed up to be part of this treaty. And it means that they're now hopefully going to help support these affected communities, because there's been an awful lot of time. And, you know, the nuclear test veterans, they've gone back home to their families, and they've, you know, live their own lives with this uncertainty around how much radiation they might have been exposed to. And many of them have had health problems and psychological challenges. And with the Indigenous communities, of course, they've just been left there and nobody has monitored them, nobody's studied them. And so we don't really have a good understanding of the impacts to these communities. My research has begun to kind of reveal some of the harms in Kurusimas, because I spend a lot of time out working with people in the Pacific to help share their experiences and to explain how it fits in the context of tests. But yeah, I think it's quite interesting and quite useful, because it kind of gives you that insight into how, thinking back to geography again, you know, these treaties can have international impacts, and all these kind of different communities around the world are brought together and able to begin to make some changes thanks to these big international UN treaties, like the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
Yes, and thinking about those kind of technologies, the second question on nuclear geotechnologies, geographical information systems, GPS, remote sensing, spatial modelling, laser range finding, digital mapping, satellite imaging. Are the geotechnologies of nuclear warfare simply geography under another name?
Totally. I would say so, absolutely. I would say as well, you know, geography is everything. Everything is geography. But particularly in this context, one of the things that geographers don't think about is we use these technologies. We use GPS. We use things like laser range finding, digital mapping, satellite imaging. But a lot of the time, the origins of these technologies are in military development or in warfare, which I think is really interesting, and it creates kind of a moral dilemma, doesn't it? Because these technologies, they're used for so much good now as well. You know, we have these kind of big mapping projects, GIS projects to kind of help with humanitarian aid. There's one going on right now in Gaza to help kind of, you know, find out where's safe, find out where isn't, and think about which areas are destroyed, which areas aren't. And the same goes with Ukraine. But a lot of these technologies do have their origins kind of back in the Cold War. And I think that's really fascinating, actually. It's one of those things that you wouldn't kind of necessarily think about in great detail, but yeah, I think it's quite important, the idea that kind of these maps, models and war games are all part of kind of preparing for nuclear war, and have kind of got these other uses now too.
Yeah, it's always useful to reflect on the fact that a lot of the technologies that we take for granted do have this sort of military origin to them, and there's this double-edged sword to how they're developed. You know, thinking about cartography, etc., something that I really liked in your book was talking about how cartography is sometimes used to sort of disguise the effect of nuclear war. So my third question, mythologies of risk. How has cartography, such as public safety, nuclear preparedness, under the guise of protect and survive style initiatives, been used to mask the destructiveness of nuclear weapons?
I love this question. Thank you so much, Mr. Simpkins. So this is really interesting for me. I think that... Yes, so when we look at the protect and survive documentation, a lot of the time there's kind of depictions and descriptions of nuclear harms, but they're very minimised. And there was an awful lot of kind of public safety nuclear preparedness materials that were put out during the kind of Cold War and during the end of the Cold War. And this was everywhere from Sweden to the UK to Russia to the US. I think the British initiative was particularly interesting because Protect and Survive was very much focused around the survival of state rather than society. So the individual was encouraged to do all sorts of kind of different little measures from, you know, painting your windows white to kind of, you know, barricading yourself in your home to make yourself feel as though you were safe, and to kind of give this idea that you could protect yourself from the destructive power of nuclear weapons. Now, of course, we know this was not possible. And it's really interesting, actually, because even if we look at kind of state endeavours to protect states against nuclear warfare, a lot of the time it was inadequate. Take, for example, the Guardian Exchange Tunnels in Manchester, which were originally developed to protect against nuclear warfare as a bunker. And then by the time they were finished, the hydrogen bomb had been developed, they were no longer effective, and they were repurposed. They were used for communications and other things for many years. But their original life's purpose was to protect humanity, and they were never going to be inadequate, because technology moved so fast. But I think it's really interesting because there was a recognition and a pushback against this, you know, this kind of depiction of the serene nuclear war where we could all, you know, if you looked through these pamphlets issued by the government, we could all survive if we, you know, took these simple measures and washed our turnips, or, you know, sorry to be flippant, but, you know, washed our vegetables and sheltered for 36 hours. And the pushback included things such as Wild Bill Bundy's Atlas of Nuclear War, which was this incredible, really politicised series of Cold War maps that depict this desolate world after nuclear attack, complete with symbologies of like disintegrating zombies roaming through this nuclear wasteland. So there was clearly also a public recognition and definitely an academic recognition that nuclear war was unsurvivable, despite the kind of misguided public information campaigns at the time. And I think that's very interesting as well, how geographers led this pushback with their own understanding and knowledge of the true impacts of nuclear war. Another quite well-known academic who pushed back, he's one of our locals, actually. We should all be proud of him, was Professor Stan Openshaw. So he was brilliant. He was an artist, he was a writer, he wrote on nuclear warfare, and he also modelled nuclear attack. And during the 1980s, in 1982, he made this amazing model of what would happen if Leeds and Sheffield were nuked. His models are arguably what you know, the TV series Friends ended up being based on. So he was consulted for the TV series Friends, which I think is amazing, because as kind of a tool to raise awareness of the harms of nuclear war, you can't really get better than like horrifying, you know, horrifying drama, can you? So yes. So I think these initiatives, these Protect and Survive initiatives, were kind of, you know, given out to the public, but they weren't, you know, the public were a bit smarter than 1980s governments gave them credit for. I think they realised that, you know, nuclear war was unsurvivable.
Yeah, and something that I hadn't contemplated before reading your book is just how the way that it's expressed on the page. So, for example, you point out that, you know, it, by putting concentric lines on the nuclear blast zone, it makes you think, oh, if I'm just outside this line, I'm okay. Or the kind of colour scheme that you use, if you use cool blues or something, it makes it feel like it's not, you know, incinerating fire. Again, these Protect and Survive documents, I've not got it at hand, but I've still got it. Way back, because I come from Doncaster, and something which sparked my interest in sort of these weapons way back as a teenager was I found a South Yorkshire County Council anti-nuclear pamphlet that was from the late 80s, and it was about South Yorkshire County Council was nuclear free, basically saying that you know, if these bombs drop in Sheffield, Doncaster, etc., this is the level of destruction. So, you know, that had an effect today to me speaking to you right now, all those years ago.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it, how these things can kind of stay with you. I think it's really interesting, kind of, like you said, like how things are depicted can affect how we understand them. So, yeah, the concentric ring model. So my PhD, I did a lot of work on computational modelling for radiation protection, and I did all the kind of plume modelling and dispersal modelling. And one of the things that's really striking with these kind of model outputs is that, you know, your dispersal doesn't comply with borders, it doesn't comply with boundaries. The dispersal of your radionuclide plume doesn't comply with these kind of concentric rings of the emergency planning zone or anything like that. And so while we can model these things, a lot of the time they are not reflected in kind of the planning documents, which I think is really, they are now, but the planning documents at the time, the contemporaneous planning documents during the Cold War, did not reflect the realities of nuclear war. And that was one of the things that Stan's models helped show, because he did these kind of early plume models and showed how the dispersal of kind of radiation after a nuclear blast would be quite different to how it was depicted by the kind of sanitized maps and cartographies that were put out by the government.
And then moving on to more recent times, my question four on a very striking term that I'd not heard before, apocatainment. So it's quite a, there's a bit of a lead in for this. So you draw a connection between Cold War nuclear strategist Herman Kahn, game theory, war gaming, geotechnologies such as topographic modelling and environment generation, and the eventual production of computer games such as Missile Command and modern post-apocalyptic computer games such as Fallout. Would you agree with the claim that the common thread linking each of these criteria is apocatainment, a tendency to abstract war to a game?
I love the phrase apocatainment, and thank you so much for this question. It is such an interesting one. And I think it's really, it's kind of almost perturbing to follow those threads from the Rand Corporation, the depths of the 1960s, and thinking through things like the prisoner's dilemma, right? Which is a part of game theory that originates, in nuclear warfare and mutually assured destruction. This kind of idea by Herman Kahn that it would be impossible to fight a kind of sane, just, and livable, survivable nuclear war due to the nature of each state and the fact that there would be a retaliative attack and obviously the impacts of things like nuclear winter. There's some amazing work going on at the moment, actually, by Alan Robock and his research group, looking at new ways to kind of define and describe nuclear winter and new ways to think through mutually assured destruction, which I think is really important. But back to apocatainment. There is a definite thread, I think. You know, you can even draw the line from things like The Prisoner's Dilemma and these kind of old war games and the first kind of computer games. And models, thinking about how we interact. So one of the things I find particularly interesting is the parallels between what we call agent-based modelling, which is one of my areas of expertise. It's a use of AI, I guess, to kind of look at how communities behave. So you use lots of individual agents. Mm-hmm. You might have hundreds of them, and it's how they behave together that creates what we call an emergent phenomena. And it's stochastic, so it's random. So if you want a bit of reference from the mathematics, most of you have probably watched Jurassic Park. Do you remember the chaos mathematician? Yeah? So it's that kind of maths. We call it partial differential equations. And sometimes people with lots of red curly hair can do it too. So yes. So there's this kind of whole mathematics behind how we do this kind of modelling. And the same mathematics is used for the computer games. I just find it remarkable. We use it for things like procedurally generated environments. And we use it for random behaviours in characters. Literally, we cannot escape partial differential equations. I think that's really kind of cool and really interesting. That's something that's not in my book, but I think everybody should be aware of. One of the things that I think is really interesting is how going kind of beyond the the building blocks of a war game to a computer game, these games draw upon kind of populist notions of kind of what nuclear war would be like what it would be like after nuclear war, like post-apocalypse, for instance, Fallout. And I think it's really interesting because the original kind of war gamers, right, they were generals, they were officers, they were these, these stern, serious, important people trying to resolve Cold War conflict. And whereas now we've all for my generation anyway, I think we've all logged on and had a game of Fallout at one point or another, or had a little go. And it's really become something that people engage with and enjoy as a way to escape from modern life. And you can make of that what you will, but I think the notion that we require, these extraordinary games as kind of an escape, is quite interesting, because you can think, day to day life is quite mundane, and so to be in this apocalyptic reality offers an alternative, doesn't it, for a few hours. My concern, of course, is whether it kind of glamorizes or glorifies, nuclear warfare, because of course we live at a time of increased geopolitical tensions, and one of the big issues of our time is, how do we solve a problem like Korea? How do we solve a problem like Putin, right? What do we do? How do we ensure that we can protect and support Ukraine, for example, and provide an adequate intervention without Russia acting irrationally and using its nuclear stockpile? And this goes back to the game theory, actually, because a lot of these original games that were developed during the 60s, this is kind of before people brought in randomness or kind of chaos maps into it. So it had kind of a more sensible logic to it. There was assumptions about how people would behave that we now know are not true. So there's an element of irrationality. And we call these kind of agents that don't behave as we expect irrational agents. In fact, I think that's a great name. And we could consider Putin to be one of these irrational agents, to kind of present this particular problem. Because, of course, if something is irrational, then how do we ensure that, that we can kind of, we know it's not going to operate within the bounds of rationality. And so this is a problem. So how do we solve this issue? I would argue that slow disarmament and maybe the deposition of Putin are two useful solutions, but I can only help with one of those. Thank you.
And a few, I was jotting down notes throughout. It's been really fascinating. A couple of things came to mind. And not least to mention that many of my students enjoy playing games like Fallout, or have done. On a geographical note, I wonder if there's something about, escaping into the earth, into sort of this womb-like safety, perhaps, that appeals to people in times of uncertainty like now.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, definitely. The idea of kind of going to your bunker and kind of bunkering down is fascinating. And there definitely is, both kind of within virtual reality, whether you've got your Oculus Rift on, you're exploring these spaces virtually, whether you're playing computer games and, going and collecting your points from your bunkers, or running away from your zombies coming up from the bunkers, also in reality as well. So one of the curious phenomena of the 21st century is the kind of abundance and the growth of the prepper movement and the survivalist movement. So I was very lucky in 2016, just before Donald Trump came into power, I got to spend some time with preppers. So I was out there in Colorado learning about their lives, their experiences, their bunkers. It was absolutely fascinating because a lot of them had kind of almost a level of futility, even though they were very determined to try and protect themselves. They very much believed that society was going to collapse, that the bomb was going to come, and that they needed to prepare. There was a generational difference. So the younger preppers, like me, although I am not a prepper, I should add. I'm very disorganized, in fact. But the younger preppers, they kind of focused on what they called skilling up. So they've developed skills to help themselves survive if something terrible happened. Whereas kind of the older generation, it was more about materialism, so more about objects and things they could collect, things they could keep, bunkers they could make, guns they could carry. And one of the things I found really fascinating is I assumed that I would mostly be speaking to men. You know, you read these kind of descriptions of prepper culture, and it's like middle-aged men with guns and bunkers and guns, right? And they're all really wealthy, and that's what they do. It was not the manpocalypse. There were loads of women. It was absolutely fascinating. And the conversations that I had with them were very much around skilling up to protect their families, but also this idea that, well, we may or may not have a nuclear apocalypse, but we're definitely going to have these kind of serious storm events. And I think with America, there's something particularly special about it spatially that makes it attractive to preppers, because you can be so far from the city, you can be so far from urban areas, you can be so far from hospitals. So, perhaps there's a bit of that kind of pioneer spirit that's, stayed in place.
Mm-hmm. And thinking about those threats today and those fears, on that geographical front, I was teaching a lesson with my students last week, and we were just talking about different ideas or theories about what causes war. So is it religion? Is it ideology? Is it land and resources? And I was asking them to think about the conflicts going on today, Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, etc. And they all came back to it's about land and resources. So even where there was sort of ideology at play or sort of religion gets layered on top, my students, without much prompting, they knew. They said, what's at stake for Putin in Russia? And, they knew about the grain fields, etc., and they knew about access to Crimea. So they were very savvy, and these are not students that are experts in international relations. They just know from looking at the news that a lot of conflicts, the basis of it is kind of a material geographic one.
That is amazing, and brilliant on your students' part. I totally agree. So the main drivers of war, I would say, are conflict scarcity and power as well, so kind of the geopolitical power dynamic. And when those two entangle, that's when you've got a problem. And one of the big issues of our time really is thinking about how we are going to manage our future in light of increased resource scarcity and increased conflict due to the climate crisis. I mean, something that I think about a lot, especially in the context of the Pacific, because a lot of Pacific spaces and Pacific islands also have this very important geopolitical role and diplomatic role as they're occupied by other nation states or used as, for example, as military bases such as Hawaii or provided new development aid in these forced impacts such as China and Kiribati. So we've got a lot to think about, haven't we, thinking forward? One of the other things I think is very curious about war at the moment is we have this notion of kind of the just war, and we have this notion of kind of fair war. And I'd say until maybe 2012, kind of warfare within my lifetime was undertaken, at least in the global north, with this in mind. Whereas arguably now, when we look at conflict, there are far more kind of legal violations in kind of the actions undertaken by both military personnel in multiple places. So we've got this other issue as well, thinking how do we manage unjust war, how do we manage irregular warfare, and how do we manage that conflict may become fiercer and more violent as resources become more scarce and power becomes more complex. But I think there is hope. I know we recently had a COP meeting, didn't we, back in December, and it sounds as though there is some change. You know, it sounds as though we are going to hopefully take action to kind of manage and prevent some of this you know, climate crisis precipitated conflict. But I do worry, and especially in the context of migration, because I think that everybody deserves a home, everybody deserves a space to live. And of course, our climate crisis is depriving communities of this space. This is already happening in the Pacific. While I've been out to these places where nuclear weapons are tested, I can see the salt water intruding on the groundwater. The groundwater lens is shrinking just in the time I've been visiting, and I've been going since 2017. And I can see plants dying. I can see palm trees dying, breadfruit dying, papaya dying. I see people's homes being destroyed by the sea, right? And there's this huge issue. We call it the nuclear climate change nexus, whereby places where nuclear weapons were tested, so these islands and deserts that I spoke about earlier on in our podcast, are now the most likely to be affected by the extremes of climate change. And there are still communities living there. There are still people living there who have lived there, like the Aboriginal communities, for thousands of years and have sacred objects, sacred trails, sacred burial grounds, you know, their heritage and culture in this site, in these sites, embedded within it. So I think one of the big challenges of the future is not just kind of mitigating and managing future conflict, but ensuring that these communities have a way to protect their culture and to survive thinking forward. And part of their culture and their heritage is thinking about this, the impact of nuclear weapons tests to these places, memorialising it and ensuring that communities can say, yes, this is my home. Yes, it was bombed against my will, but it is still my home. And, you know, if people want to stay there, they should be able to. So there's many different issues, isn't there, thinking forward. War is really important, but I think also kind of ways that we can create peace and ways that we can help people stay in their homes are also really important too.
Exactly. And I think you've alluded to this just then, but the thought occurred to me, what do you feel is the biggest contribution that geography and geographers can make to a nuclear-free world going forward?
Geographers are amazing. I'm not biased. But seriously, they are so interdisciplinary. Geography is the only discipline that allows you to understand humanity, society, environment, warfare, and bring all these ideas together. It trains you in statistics, social science, environmental monitoring, the lot. You are ready to go out there and make some changes if you study, a geography degree or you study your geography A-level, right? So geographers have a really important role to play because they have the overarching view that other disciplines cannot and do not have. They have this understanding of community impacts, environmental impacts, humanitarian impacts. Their field trips train them for any terrain. I always say, you go on a field trip to Scotland, you're fit to go to Syria, seriously. But being serious, geography is, it's a very useful discipline from that perspective. But I think geographers are unique and actually also quite often caring about things, right? So we become geographers because we care about the world, because we want to maybe make the world a better place. We want to understand an issue that we care about, whether it's climate change, warfare, migration, poverty, the big critical challenges of our time, wicked problems maybe. So as geographers, you are tooled, you are ready, but you also have the right mindset to create change. And I always get very excited about kind of the geographers of the future, those of you who are still studying and still learning, because you are the people who are going to precipitate that change, and we're waiting to help you.
Yeah, thank you. That's really positive. I'm reminded that you were recently at the United Nations. Can you tell us more about that, please?
Absolutely. I was, it was a privilege to be invited. I was a delegate and speaker at the United Nations for the second meeting of the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. So I mentioned earlier that I do a lot of work on Article 6 and Article 7 for humanitarian aid and environmental issues. And I was lucky enough to work with some amazing colleagues at ICANN, at Harvard University, at the UNA, and also with the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation to help develop a framework to kind of find out, what the best way to implement the new treaty is. So when I was out at Kiribati this summer, I was collecting data to make sure we knew how to use the treaty best. And I was working with the local community to try and create what we call epistemic justice. So that's justice of knowledge. It's about making sure we know what communities want, listening to them, ensuring that they have access to information in their language, so Ikiribati, and ensuring that they receive training and support to participate fully in democratic processes, like going to the UN and speaking. So while I was there, I helped organise for 5 women from the island to come with me to New York and to do some speaking themselves, because I think their voice is far more powerful than mine. I'm just an academic and policymaker. They actually have that lived experience. And I also organised several art workshops. So a lot of my work, I'm quite an unusual academic because my work kind of spans photography and creative practice and the computational stuff. I think I'm part of a new breed, basically. More of us are kind of more diverse nowadays because we realise that there's issues to solve rather than kind of topics to, topics to explore with one method. So while I was there, I organised painting workshops with the children to get some brilliant paintings by them, which were exhibited in New York. So we had our exhibition in New York of their amazing art. It was absolutely brilliant. I was there speaking, obviously, about my own research and the issues that the Kiribati community in particular have experienced, and also sharing a kind of multi-organisational statement. So I worked with 200 different organisations to help put the statement together about how we condemn nuclear weapons and about how we look forward to creating a nuclear weapons-free world and about the steps that we're personally taking to help generate justice and support for nuclear weapons affected communities. So it was a massive privilege. I met some amazing people. I shook a lot of hands. I was also photographing part of the event as well for Lex International, which is Beatrice Fine from ICANN's new project. So I was very busy. When I wasn't interviewing, I was photographing. And when I wasn't photographing, I was speaking. I think these policy events are really important, and particularly the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, because they give the community that cares a chance to get together and to discuss these issues and work out the next steps. So one of the big issues with the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is so it has 96 signatories who ratified the treaty, and it's created these vast swathes of nuclear-free world. The nuclear weapon possessor states in places like China, Russia, France, the US, India, Pakistan, North Korea, these places that still have nuclear weapons, they're not going to give them up, right? They're still clinging on. And so there's this kind of dichotomy, really, whereby we're kind of pushing for change and they're not really doing anything. But I would figure that having the treaty in place re-embeds something that we call the nuclear taboo. So this was created by a very smart professor called Nina Tannenwald, and she argued that the nuclear taboo, so increasing the likelihood that we kind of look at nuclear weapons with horror and disgust rather than with approval, is something that could help with disarmament. So I feel as though the treaty will help the affected communities and help re-embed the nuclear taboo. And I always think it's better to be on the right side of history. I suspect that in the future, when we look back at the barbaric harm caused by nuclear weapons and nuclear warfare, then, we might look at this treaty and think, oh, why didn't everybody sign up sooner? So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much for the work you've been doing on that. Really
thank
important.
You.
Thank you. And I suppose just to round up a little bit, I'm just struck by the thought, what was it that got you initially interested in geography, in nuclear weapons, etc.?
Really good question. So I have always loved geography. I come from a non-geographical academic background originally. I was in physical sciences. But I had this great passion for kind of environmental science. Before I went to university, I was always like out, and you know, I'd get the train out to the countryside, I'd go walking, and whenever I walk around a city, I'd be thinking about, you know, the different people and why are the homeless people, what's going on in the world. I guess I was kind of a natural geographer and didn't realize. I think geography is a really powerful and really useful subject to study. And with war, sounds really simple, but I just care. You know, you grow up, and like as a kid, I remember like the Bosnian War. You know, I remember I took my poor boyfriend at the time on the march for the as a teenager for the Iraq War march down in Hyde Park. I remember like, you know, chewing on a chocolate bar in Hyde Park, feeling very radical. So I think it's kind of a combination of factors. I wouldn't say it's just one thing that's kind of encouraged me to care. I'd say it's one of these things though, isn't it? You're kind of alive in the world, the media bombards you with this information, and you either kind of, you can kind of become anaesthetized to it, or you can kind of sit and think about it a bit and decide that you want to try and take some action. And I think that I was always kind of the sort of person who was more likely to think and to question and to go why. I've always been quite a critical thinker. And so I think it's my kind of slightly critical nature that has led me to geography, to the study of peace, and to the study of warfare. And also because it is something that is such a part of our humanity, we have always been fighting. Literally, you go back through history, it is conflict after conflict after conflict, right? It is something that we have not resolved. We have not figured out as a society how to live peacefully. You know, it is our flaw. Humanity's great flaw is we don't know how to avoid conflict. You know, I don't think it's something that will be resolved in my lifetime. But I think that one of the most important things that we can do on this planet is to contribute to our understanding of why we fight.
Absolutely. Becky, this has been a really great episode. I think it fits in really well with what I'm trying to do with Hypervelocity, which is bring out how those technologies link with the strategies of warfare. Because obviously when we think of nuclear weapons, we obviously just think of the bomb, but we don't think of all the you know, the mapping, the geography, all those different technologies that go into that. And that's why I think your book is so good. Because it shows how those technologies work, but the more importantly, the impact that they have on actual people. I think you've got a real knowledge and passion. You know, your passion for this subject and what you're trying to do, and the action that you're taking comes across. So I really appreciate you coming to speak with me this evening. I look forward to sharing this with my students and the wider internet.
Thank you. It has been an absolute pleasure. Best of luck with your future episodes. I look forward to continuing to listen to your amazing podcast.
Thank you very much.